You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Charlotte Walmsley, a PhD researcher focusing on post-conflict gender violence. Gender violence is a term that we use several times in this interview, and so I thought it would be good to give a clear and concise definition of the term. I am by no means an expert on the topic, but there is a good quote here from the European Institute for Gender Equality. You can find more links about this type of information in the show notes. Quote, "Gender-based violence and violence against women are terms that are often used interchangeably, as it has been widely acknowledged that most gender-based violence is inflicted on women and girls by men. However, using the gender-based aspect is important, as it highlights the fact that many forms of violence against women are rooted in power inequalities between women and men." With that in mind, let's get to the interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm joined by Charlotte Walmsley, a PhD researcher focusing on post-conflict gender violence, including that which occurred after the Spanish Civil War. Charlotte, thank you for joining me today. How's it going?
It's going well, thank you. It's going well. It's 2020, so it's a...
it's an experience.
It's an experience, absolutely, absolutely. But thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. When we look at Spain during the Second Republic, what was the state of women's rights before the Civil War began?
Okay, so I think to analyze the state of women's rights before the war began, I think it's important to go back a little bit further than the Second Republic in order to kind of contextualize the gains that had been made under the Second Republic. So in order to sort of understand Spain at the turn of the century, we're talking about an overwhelmingly agrarian country with incredibly high rates of illiteracy, very uneven process of industrialization. And so sort of within that context, you have such high illiteracy rates as sort of we're looking at sort of at the turn of the century, sort of around 71.5% of women are illiterate. And it's only in 1909 that women are able to sort of, it becomes mandatory for women to go to primary school up until the age of 12. So in this sort of, within this context, it's sort of a very traditional society, particularly in sort of rural areas like Andalusia, where the state of sort of gendered relations is very traditional. And of course, before the Second Republic, you have a military dictatorship as well under Primo de Rivera until 1930. So when the Republic is established in 31, they establish a constitution. And within the constitution, this sort of lays the groundwork for enormous gains within a very, very short period of time. So within that, in 1932, put in place some of the most sort of progressive divorce legislation across Europe, which obviously is sort of really jars with the sort of that sort of backdrop. And also they put in place female suffrage. So although there is actually, even amongst women socialists, so Margarita Nelkin, who's involved in the Spanish Socialist Party at this time, is actually frightened about women getting the right to vote because she fears that they will actually prop up the right. So there's a lot of misgivings about women getting the vote across the political spectrum in this period, just because, as I said, sort of the state of education for women is questionable, particularly in rural spaces, and you have an overwhelming power of the Catholic Church within the education system as well. But yes, you have these, in this very short window of time, these huge gains that are made in terms of women's rights. But of course, then in the 1933 elections, you then, when women vote, and it's not just because of women, but then there is a return to sort of a right-wing coalition comes in, and you have what's known as the sort of the Bienio Negro, the two dark years or black years, where a lot of the gains that are made are sort of their attempts to sort of stymie any further social progress. And so you have like what is an incredibly divided society. So before the Spanish Civil War erupts, 1936, you have the left-wing Popular Front coming to power, but obviously huge social divisions. And so sort of some historians such as Joe Labagny and Helen Graham have talked about how, you know, the Spanish Civil War is all about fighting sort of conflicting cultural models of Spanishness as well as different sort of economic understandings. So within that context, you have these enormous gains, but also a huge amount of backlash and sort of contestation around that.
And I guess, so when the war starts, we start seeing the trend of women, at least on the Republican side, going to the front in militias and things. But that practice was curtailed on the Republican side. Do you know sort of what led into that change?
Well, it's really, really fascinating because, again, there's this sort of this really quick sort of shift again. So in 1936, there's not a sort of a targeted call for women to join the front lines. But what you have is a spontaneous sort of movement. You do have women coming forward and sort of going to the front to fight, which is, you know, it is quite remarkable in this context, that women were putting themselves forward. However, in a very, you also have women in the rear guard. You have women sort of, the idea is that they should be able to defend cities as well. But yes, you have women fighting on the front line as milicianas. And within this, you have initially they've used a lot for sort of propaganda. So they're used in the Republican press. They're also used as a sort of, I suppose, motivation for men to join the front. You know, see, these women are joining the front, and so there's also sort of an uncomfortable undercurrent there in terms of that sort of messaging. And you do have some very prominent women, female milicianas, within this sort of Mica Echeve, sorry, I can't pronounce her name, Mica Echeverri, who sort of leads a column within this period in 1936. Again, this sort of short period, but sort of by September 1936, Largo Caballero, who is the prime minister at the time, or head of government, is already sort of making calls for women to be taken back from the front. So some women refuse. It's obviously, in terms of women on the front line, we're talking about a small number of women. So the historian Mary Nash thinks around sort of, we're talking in the hundreds, maybe 200, potentially even under 200 women. But yes, in a very short period of time, this window of opportunity, I suppose, is sort of very quickly closed. And George Orwell talks about this as sort of the framing of these women has gone from eulogy to discredit in a very, very short period of time. And so the motivations for that are numerous. One of the arguments is that there's a view that, so there's, it wasn't across the left that ever in 1936, when women were fighting on the front lines, that all of the leftist parties were pro this. So the Socialist Party was not. The Socialist Party argued for the sort of the home front heroine rather than the frontline militia. And there was sort of a lot of gendered anxiety around women carrying guns and fighting at the front in trench warfare, even though as sort of memoirs attest, that is what these women were doing, and they were perfectly capable of doing so, while also, unfortunately, bearing the double burden of their gender by also being expected to take on a lot of auxiliary tasks, sort of cooking, cleaning, sewing, and things like that. But there is this sort of real shift, and that these women are framed very quickly as sort of, there's concerns around sex on the front lines. There's concerns, interestingly though, there's no concerns around sexual harassment of women on the front lines.
Of course not.
Absolutely not. It's all about the concern about sex and sort of sexual intercourse at the front lines. There's concerns about venereal disease. In 1937, there's sort of the small amount of documentation there is points to sort of surges in venereal disease, although a lot of people argue that that was happening more in the home front, on the home front, which is curious in itself, rather than on the front lines. And there's also sort of a framing of these women as prostitutes as well. So there's a sort of, again, these appeals to sort of appropriate feminine morality, appropriate feminine behavior, despite the fact that these women fought in quite significant battles along the Aragon front, around along Guadalajara, but these women were very quickly sort of, by 1937, there's this real shift and away from that. And it's kind of, there's something very sort of, I suppose quite sort of depressing about that, because it's sort of, initially there's this sort of the valorization of the miliciana, and then very quickly this sort of fall from grace. And it's sort of centered around these gendered anxieties around sex, anxieties about appropriate roles for women. But also, I mean, even within the calls for people to join the front for men as well, there's sort of appeals to very traditional views around, you know, masculinity. Sort of, you know, women were encouraged in sort of 1937, 1938 to denounce the cowards, the able-bodied men who were not fighting at the front. So it's sort of, it's still functioning within a very sort of gendered space, even on the left, understandings of the war. So it's quite complicated.
So we've talked about the propaganda used by the Republican forces and the left, but on the other side, you have Franco and his coalition, I guess, on the right. And they have very different views of gender roles within society. So how are these women who are fighting, but also, you know, women just in general on the Republican side, how are they portrayed in Francoist propaganda, I guess?
Well, as you can imagine, quite negatively. So you there's so much of the uprising and the coup led by the nationalist rebels and sort of headed by Franco is sort of framed as a crusade for Spanishness. And so within that sort of ideological structure, you have the ideas of sort of a return to imperial Spain, a return to sort of military Spain, a return to order. And within that, of course, there's obviously some very, very clear gendered hierarchies and structures. And so the figure of the miliciana is a sort of a real ideological source there in terms of, you know, representing, you know, this sort of mannish woman. This, they refer to them as sort of the non-woman. They talk about the miliciana as a bestia roja, a sort of a red beast, this sort of non-woman, and that's such a source of anxiety, because again, kind of going back to that context, when we were talking about education for women in the first part of the 20th century, the Catholic Church was so against any sort of co-education, so women and men being taught together, and that this would sort of unravel the fabric of society. And so these idea of gender roles is so integral to a sort of understanding of Spanishness and understanding of women as, you know, as caregivers. And so this is hugely destabilizing. And again, there's sort of understandings of it. It all comes back to also a lot of sexual anxieties as well, in terms of, you know, these, there's later on in sort of at the end of the Spanish Civil War, you have a prominent Francoist psychiatrist, Dr. Antonio Vallejo Najera, who studies with the red women and tries to identify a red gene, and the idea of these women as having as being militaristic or inciting violence because of their sort of latent sexual appetites. And so it's sort of all within this framework of this sort of dangerous, deviant, dissident female behavior and sexuality and strength, which is so alien. And then you have as well, kind of comparative to sort of a lot of the women's movements on the left, you have the emergence of, in 1934, of La Sección Femenina, the feminine section, which is the kind of the female counterpart for the Francoist militia, the Falange. And that's headed, interestingly, by a woman. So all these women are sort of empowered within the Francoist structure, but only within very strict limitations. And their sort of idea is all about sort of teaching what it is to be a woman in Francoist Spain. And so these conflicting cultural models of femininity. And within that, and then later on, you have the sort of the emergence of the Patronato de Protección a la Mujer, which is in 1941, this idea of this board of protection for women in early Francoism, which is all about sort of promoting appropriate female morality and behavior. And again, a sort of a close interweaving with a lot of sort of very traditional Catholic morality. And so, of course, this is sort of the figure of the feminine soldier, the combatant, is so at odds with those sorts of cultural understandings, and they, you know, in testimonies and memoirs, women, female militia, so Mica Echeverri, I will always struggle to pronounce her name. and also the example of Lina Odena, who is known as sort of a female martyr, miliciana, who killed herself instead of being captured by the Francoist troops because of her fear of what would happen to her. And sort of this sort of becomes a site of discomfort as well, that these women faced huge violence. So Mica Echeverri talks about how women would cut their hair so that their hair couldn't be shaved if they were taken by the Francoist troops, or there was sort of a lot of fears around sexual violence about what would happen to them. And in the case of Lina Odena, she chose to shoot herself rather than to be taken by the Francoist troops. And so although there's a lot of denial in the Francoist press, you know, we would never do this. And there's a culture of denial around the violence against leftist women in the Francoist press as well. But yes, no, a culture of real sort of suspicion, distrust and a sort of violence against these sort of leftist women, absolutely.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
So you mentioned that there are women who are very concerned about being captured. Obviously, we know that the Spanish Civil War does not go well for the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so for women who were imprisoned by the Francoist forces and the Francoist regime, I guess, after the Civil War, what were conditions like in prisons and concentration camps? I assume they were like separated based on what you've said about gender sort of places within that society.
So yes, absolutely. There's a sort of separate spheres logic that kind of goes into the sort of the what Helen Graham talks about as the Franco's prison universe as well. So you have huge numbers of incarcerated women in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, but also like as different regions are taken over. So in areas I focus a lot on Andalusia. And so for sort of areas like Seville, they're almost, in one interview, I was told, you know, that we never had a war, we just had repression, because they're taken over so quickly. And so within that context, women, leftist women, or, you know, wives, daughters, sisters of well-known either Republican fighters who may have been absent also, at the time that these areas were taken over, they may have been fighting at the front. Women were incredibly vulnerable, even if they weren't necessarily particularly politically engaged. And so you have mass crowding of prisons. So one example that is helpful, I think, to illuminate this is the example of Las Ventas, which is one of the most infamous prisons of this period. In Madrid, which was originally set up by Victoria Kent, who was in charge of prison reform under the Second Republic. And during this sort of, the idea was, this was the example of sort of Republican progressive views on prison reform and rehabilitation. It was a prison for women. It was meant to house, you know, women in their hundreds, and it ends up housing women in their thousands under Franco. And so you have mass crowding of prisons. Sometimes women, you know, pregnant women, you have women on sort of the charges. I've gone through, as part of my research, I've gone through a lot of the files for women who were in prison during this period. And it's incredibly tenuous claims. So it can be things sort of as vague as inciting violence. So they don't necessarily have even had to have committed acts of violence themselves. They may have incited acts of violence, and it could be connections. And so as well, like at the end of the Spanish Civil War, you have the 1939 Law of Political Responsibilities, and so that means that anyone who supported the Popular Front or anyone who supported the Second Republic could be accused of supporting. The military, they frame the leftist defense of Spain and of the Republic and democracy as a rebellion itself. So it's a sort of really quite clever propaganda.
It's broad.
And then huge. So you could, women were could very easily be accused, and you know, these very dubious trials, and it's. Thanks to the work of Tomasa Cuevas, who herself was imprisoned under the Francoist regime, sort of collected all of these different testimonies of women There's a lot of discussion about sort of women having their heads shaved in prison. There's a lot of discussion about the sort of the scarcity of food. There's discussions around use of torture, sort of using electric shock. There's a huge, alongside, of course, execution. The levels of violence are really quite, in some cases, quite medieval. The one case I came across of in Seville was of one poor woman who's killed by garrote. So it's a really quite a bleak picture for women. Obviously in comparison to sort of male population in prisons and concentration camps, it's lower, but it's still a massive surge. So in the initial sort of periods that sort of zones are taken over, the female population rockets disproportionately to sort of average rates of female criminality, as it were, huge surges.
When reading about the experiences of women in these situations, you sent me over some information to read, and this will be linked in the show notes for anybody listening. It almost feels like the sort of imprisonment, the public humiliation, the mental and emotional abuse that these women suffered was fueled almost by a belief that they were infringing upon some fundamental part of Spanish culture, and that had to be punished in some way. Do you think that's an accurate assessment of what's happening?
I would absolutely agree with that assessment. I think the culture of violence and the kind of the ecosystem of violence in this period is one of exemplary violence. So women are sort of publicly shamed. So in sort of the early Spanish Civil War, there's a report written by the International Red Cross in the Basque country, and they talk about all of these parades of women who've had their heads shaved, who are taken through towns and cities. This is happening in rural and urban spaces, having their heads shaved, forced to do fascist salutes, forced to wear signs. Sometimes they'd be forced to sort of wear sort of the monarchist colours to sort of further humiliate them. There's also the forced sort of ingestion of castor oil, which is particularly barbaric because it's a laxative. So it causes women to be violently sick. It causes women to sort of be unable to control themselves. And so there's this sort of very physical purging sort of on the streets, this humiliation of these women who are made sort of hyper visible as examples. It's not just to break their spirit, but also to send a message to the wider community about what is appropriate female behavior, and what is the role of women in Spain. And so you have these sort of, again, these opposing models of sort of the exaltation of sort of the sort of very traditional values of femininity, and then along Catholic lines, along sort of religious lines, this sort of, and the sección femenina very much promotes this idea of the sort of the submissive woman as mother, this idea of sort of obedient female heroines. And then on the other side, you have these sort of, the red women are viewed as sort of figures of degeneration, and of sort of a loss of order, a loss of control. And that's the sort of the message that is spread within the community. And it's also, I suppose it's also the fact that they were sort of really easy scapegoats as zones were taken over. If men were absent and they couldn't publish, they couldn't publicly punish Republican soldiers in the same way, but they could then punish their mothers, their sisters, their wives, their daughters. And so it becomes the sort of, there's a lot of discussion around sort of the spectacle of violence and sort of sending messages into the wider community. And I think these women were absolutely viewed as a threat to traditional Spanish motherhood. And within the sort of the first few years of Francoism, you have, the 1931 constitution that gave women the right to vote, that gave women sort of the right to divorce and all of these different things, 1931, 1932, all of that is undermined, and you instead have the Civil Code of 1889 put in, which makes which makes women legal minors. So their husband, that sort of enshrines the idea of women as sort of unequal to men, and you have, it enforces the idea of patria potestad, so the supremacy of the father, so and of the husband, and so women lose all of their rights really within this period, and then you have the promotion of these sort of very traditional views of womanhood, and these women don't fit within that. And this is, I suppose, that this idea of public punishment, you could frame it as sort of a means to purge them of their past, and there's a sense of redemption, but there's still huge amounts of stigmatization and ostracization of these women afterwards as well. And some of these women are in prison for absolutely years for incredibly nebulous crimes.
So, you know, after the war, we have several decades of sort of Franco in power. Did the prevalence of gender violence sort of change or evolve in a meaningful way during this period, or did reforms really have to wait until after?
Mm-hmm. So within, as I was sort of saying, in terms of the civil code, it's incredibly difficult for women to voice any complaints, and it's incredibly, women can't get divorced, contraception is no longer legal. You have all of these sort of controls upon women's behavior, and you have in 1941, what I was talking about before in terms of the Patronato de Protección a la Mujer, the Board of Protection of Women, you have a structure where in sort of women who do not fit within female morality, appropriate female morality, can be punished. And you have women who, so unwed mothers are can be taken in by the state, and their children are then sort of taken from them. So women lose a lot of, unwed mothers are sort of disempowered, but then you also have, if you're a wife and a mother, you have no power comparative to your husband. And so it's incredibly difficult for women to voice any sort of complaint. There's no real protection in place for them within this. You know, there's into the 40s, prison violence is still described in memoirs and testimonies. You still have the use of head shaving, although this is much less common in this period. But women can still be arrested on very dubious claims for under the law of political responsibilities. And it's just this culture of, it's very hard. There's been such a sort of regression that it's very hard to sort of see any opportunity for things to really change in a meaningful way. I think the sort of the extremes of violence that you see in the Spanish Civil War abate, but in terms of, it's incredibly difficult really to quantify, but if you were to look at issues such as domestic abuse, there are no real protections. Women can't get a divorce, women can't escape these sorts of confines. And so it's incredibly kind of difficult to look at it in and sort of say that there's much improvement there. And it's sort of within the 1960s and 1970s, there is some sense of progress in that women are starting to go to university in larger numbers, and there is some sort of questioning there, but you still have women in certain sectors are discouraged from being married and continuing to work. Women can't open a bank account when they're married without the permission of their husband. So you have a lot of still very sort of regressive policies and attitudes towards women. However, in the 70s, there is a sort of a push. There is a push by some activists to change the civil code. And in fact, Franco allows a commission to sort of edit the some sections of the civil code to give women more rights, and this does go through in 1975. But of course, this is when his the dictatorship comes to an end, and he dies. but it's sort of a really slow burn in terms of any sort of change regarding women. And as well, you still have a culture of censorship, of extreme traditional morality, sort of films are censored, books are censored, all the way right through into the 70s. And in terms of what I was talking about, in terms of unwed mothers and them being sort of institutionalized and their children being taken away from them, which is known in Spain as the stolen children, los bebés robados, but that still goes on up until the end of the regime. And so in terms of gender violence, there's sort of violence that disproportionately affects the gender. I think that sort of there's an institutional level of violence, and there's also sort of much harder to quantify, but continuing violence in prisons, in institutions, in behind closed doors, that continues really until the end.
When we look back from the modern day, how is this the violence, sort of everything we've talked about today, remembered? Is it contentious like some other events during this period of Spanish history?
Yes, the short answer. So when, as I'm sure, you know, this podcast will engage with a lot, the sort of the culture of silence that sort of emerges in the immediate aftermath, you know, the 1977 Amnesty Act, the Pact of Silence, as it's more commonly known, sort of stymies discussion of Francoist repression against women, and as it sort of silences repression as a whole. And it's sort of, I think it's that much more difficult because you have, you know, looking at the archival documents of these women who were imprisoned, all of these documents are written by Francoists. So it's incredibly hard to get a sense of exactly what was happening. You have a huge sense of erasure there. And so you have that, you know, as I was talking about in terms of Tomasa Cuevas and her work in terms of getting these testimonies out there, and sort of a lot of a push towards oral history, because there's sort of no, with an amnesty, obviously there's no potential for judicial redress for people who've suffered during this period. And because of the nature of some of the violence, such as, you know, head shaving, it's so inherently shame, it's so tied up in shaming, it's designed to be shaming and humiliating. It's incredibly difficult to empower people, you know, as again, talking about people who, you know, may not have even necessarily been literate, women who may not have necessarily been literate, and sort of now obviously much older, sort of how can they, where can they complain? Who can they complain to?
And with the length of time this takes place, I guess, you know, for a lot of women, you would think that maybe they've tried to move past that period, right? That they have a life to live past that.
Absolutely. And I think that there have been some very brave women who have talked about the violence that they endured. But this predominantly is sort of women who were imprisoned. So there's a really fascinating documentary that I would recommend for any Spanish speakers. And it's up on YouTube, actually. And it's called Presas de Franco, so female inmates of Franco. And they take a lot of experiences of different women who are talking all about their experiences within Franco's prison. But these women were largely activists. So they were more empowered, potentially anyway, so more comfortable talking about their experiences now. And I suppose there's a sense of vindication, right? You know, we fought on the right side now. But for sort of women who may have experienced, you know, extrajudicial violence, you know, gender violence, shaming violence on the streets, simply for being the, you know, a family member of a Republican fighter or a mayor, it's not so easy to do so. So you have had in Andalusia, it's really interesting, you know, in 2010, they brought in, because so much of sort of this policy is devolved, although there are attempts now with 2020, 2021 to bring in a new law of historical memory. But with the Andalusian regional government, they brought in reparations for women who faced head shaving in 2010, which was highly contentious, sort of more widely, because there's always this idea of a sort of a tit for tat that happens in terms of, oh, well, you know, this violence happened against leftist women, but then, you know, on the right, they will evoke violence against nuns particularly. And so there's this idea of, there's still a real struggle around the disproportionate violence that women endured at the hands of Francoists. This is not at all to minimize violence on the other side, which also did happen. But the systematic use of these sorts of practices that's decried by, you know, the International Red Cross in 1936, 1937, there has to be a recognition of that. But within that policy of giving reparations in Andalusia to these women who experienced head shaving, you know, there was positive press response, but there was also very negative press response to it. And so it's still a sort of a real hot button issue despite so much time passing, just because it's sort of, it's this idea on the right of sort of opening historical wounds is how they frame it. It's sort of sowing the seeds of division, because there's such a history of political division. There's a sort of real fear of bringing that out again. But also, I think, you know, there's a sort of a real struggle around sort of the recognition of so many people who still don't know what's happened to their family members in Spain. It's a very emotive issue still.
Thank you for joining me here today for this interview. It's been really great talking to you.
Thank you ever so much. It's been great talking to you.